And as aid workers flock to Haiti, the high-tech community has mobilized as well. They're banding together to create digital tools in support of the relief efforts. Today, hundreds of techies are volunteering at marathon hacking events they're calling crisis camps. One of these camps is taking place this morning here at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Andy Carvin is NPR's senior strategist for social media. He's one of the event organizers, and he joins us here in the studio. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Adi.
So first tell me how crisis camps came together and what it is exactly you guys are doing.
Well, there's a history of bloggers and software developers getting together in times of crisis going back at least 5 years now. Thanks to the growth of social networking and Twitter, we've suddenly started to mobilize in such a way that it's become a lot easier to get people together in person to develop software that can hopefully help relief efforts. So, for example, when we started this about a week and a half ago, one of the projects that was developed was to create an iPhone app that would allow people to translate Creole to English and English back to Creole. And it's also available on Google Android phones. There are also efforts that have started to involve software companies like Google, for example. I've been working with them, among other folks, to try to figure out a way of connecting all the various missing persons databases, because the Red Cross, of course, has the big missing persons database, but lots of blogs and news websites have started collecting lists of missing people as well. So Google has stepped up and actually figured out a way to connect all of these things together and hopefully help find some people in the process.
Can you talk about other ways that this is going to benefit Haitians directly?
When it comes to creating tools that are mostly online, we have to acknowledge the fact that only about 10% of the Haitian population is online. So most of these tools are being designed in terms of assisting aid workers and other agencies that are down there. Having said that, there are things that we think are directly benefiting Haitians, such as the translation tools that the aid workers are using. There have also been attempts to invite many, many hundreds of volunteers to go through huge collections of photos of people being pulled out of the rubble or people being seen on the street of Haiti and actually trying to identify who they are. And we've actually started to have some success with that as well. So the benefits aren't always direct towards Haitians, but it's certainly helping the overall relief efforts.
Andy Carvin is NPR's senior strategist for social media. Andy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Picture a bleak, post-apocalyptic American wasteland. Nearly all of humanity's wiped out, save for a solitary, dust-covered man carrying a sword and a mysterious book.
It's a weapon! A weapon aimed right at the hearts and minds of the weak and the desperate. It will give us control of it. If we want to rule more than one small town, we have to have it. People will come from all over. They know exactly what I tell them if the words are from the book.
The Book of Eli, starring Denzel Washington, is the work of directors Albert and Alan Hughes, better known as the Hughes Brothers. It's the first movie in nearly 9 years for the duo, who also directed such films as Menace to Society and Dead Presidents. Albert and Alan Hughes join me now from the studios of NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you.
You guys are, first of all, it's fraternal twins, not identical twins?
Well, they said back then we were fraternal, but there was a lot of mistakes made in the early 70s, and we haven't had a DNA test. I suspect we're identical, though.
Even though I'm 60 pounds heavier than my brother right
now. That's just because I don't eat. This is Albert.
Because if I said the name, I might insult someone. Now, because I know that you guys are heavily involved in script writing and script development, I want you to talk about what drew you to the Book of Eli as a story.
Well, Alan, I think you should start with that, and then I'll finish with it, because he came to Alan first.
You see how we're doing our names perfectly for NPR? It's Alan talking. Well, I read the script came. My agent said, I finally found the movie for you. And I said, what's the title? And he said, The Book of Eli. And I just remember going, wow, what a great title. And what's the log line? Lone warrior walking across the wasteland, post-nuclear, with the last Bible on the planet, and the bad guy wants it to reboot civilization. I read it, first 45 pages. At the 45-page mark, Gary Oldman's character, Carnegie, says just what you had at the clip there. It's not just a book, it's a weapon. And that's when the hair stood up, and I never had that kind of moment. And I read the rest of it, and it really finished strong, and I called Albert.
He goes, this script, you got to read this script, you got to read this, you know. And I said, okay, I'll read it. So I started reading it, and I'm flipping to the page, and I'm like, wow, this is cool, this is interesting. And then by the end, I just had kind of an uneasiness about what I just read, and it was more to do with the spirituality and religious.
I want to ask about that, because usually in these dystopias, The big resource that people are battling over might be energy. It might be water. Mm-hmm. With this, not only is it a book, it's spiritual knowledge.
Well, at first, that's what scared me about it, because I'm not a true believer. And
that's Albert.
Yeah, and I called him up, and I said, I just read it. I don't know about this. And he sounded deflated, and he basically said, well, just go to sleep on it. And he had been playing this Trent Reznor song for me the week before, and it's not for me, it was just playing in his car. It's called Zero Sum. And when I went to sleep, that song is what got me into the movie. I actually had a dream about the movie because I liked the song so much. And then I woke up and I totally got it. And I saw what you can do with that kind of material if handled right. You can show the good and bad side of what we're fascinated by about religion. You know, it's like it's not so much the books as it is the people that mess up things.
Were there any concerns about it basically being considered a Christian movie or an evangelical movie? Because I know the audience I was in, I got the sense that people were actually surprised when this part of the plot was unveiled. And mm-hmm. there was a little bit of looking around and like, wait a second, am I in the right place?
Yeah. I think the concern was just trying to strike a great spiritual balance. Whether you're a non-believer or a Buddhist or a Hindu, you know,
Muslim
or Native American, there's a certain oneness that was met in the movie where everybody can get something out of it. It just so happens that this person, Eli's personal journey involved the King James Version of the Bible.
Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for us. For out of the ground we were taken, for the dust we are. And to the dust we shall return.
It's not about the Bible to us, really. You know, that's a big part of the story, but it's about the guy. And in the end, you know, we read a lot of stuff out there. We know that this topic is controversial, but, you know, the Christians have embraced it, and that's great, you know. The problem is more with my people, you know, we're liberals. And it's just interesting to me how a person like that can go into a Star Wars film or a Lord of the Rings film and totally buy into the fantasy if you're, let's say, an atheist liberal. But if you go into a movie like this, you can't buy into the fantasy of it.
You know what I found interesting? This is Alan speaking, is that I don't consider myself a liberal anymore, and I'm definitely not conservative. But if you look at the liberal left liberal and the right conservative, they're both so predictable. There's been critics who've given us high marks in the past and have body slammed this movie because of the Bible, because of the
Bible. But they won't say it, though.
They won't say it. You think
that's what's behind it.
Yeah, you can tell what's behind it because they're smart critics, and they're not quantifying their hatred for the movie at all. They're just, it rubs them the wrong way. I think it's a good thing.
I'm speaking with Albert and Alan Hughes, directors of the new film starring Denzel Washington called The Book of Eli. Now, I also want to ask you how you got Denzel Washington involved and how he came to be a part of the picture.
It's a very interesting journey with Denzel, because we met Denzel probably 17 years ago when we were in a Cannes Film Festival in the French airport at the, what do they call that, the baggage rack?
Yeah.
And over the years, we had seen him and we had conversations with him, never in a professional capacity, but always kind of like the great crazy uncle that would come around and have geopolitical conversations with us. I mean, long conversations with us. And this came up when we just signed on to the movie. We had a big meeting with the top brass of Warner Brothers, and all the $20 million actors were on the table. And I don't know why I was hesitant, but after going through the first three guys, I said, what about Denzel? And the room stopped, and you can just see they all were like, wow. Only he probably is the only one that can pull this role off. So Denzel went to Denzel. Unlike a lot of actors, Denzel's very decisive. He responds no right away or yes right away, and we got in the room with him right away. That still wasn't an easy process. It took he kind of veered away from it and did other things. And it was his son, who's a professional football player by the name of John David Washington, who read it and said, Pops, you need to revisit this. This is his eldest son, the same one that convinced him to do Training Day, for which he wanted his first lead male actor. What do they call that one?
Best actor Oscar?
Best actor. Mm-hmm. And his son also convinced him to do American Gangster. So he had a great track record with his father, and his father reconsidered, read it, and the rest is history.
Well, it's been 9 years since your last film, and I have to ask what you've been doing in that time, and am I going to have to wait another 9 years before there's another Hughes Brothers film?
You are sweet.
Well, I would hope not, because we'd be walking in with like wheelchairs and a cane. the rate we're going right now, it's a combination of a lot of things. It's like we always like to live our life. The elements have to be right for us to make a movie. If there's one personality off in that room, and you know, we'll bow out gracefully. The material doesn't speak to us like, on an emotional level. It can be an action movie, it can be great, but you know, it needs to speak to us.
And there will not be another 9 years, but I can guarantee one thing for me, and I'm sure Albert will agree, is that we're connoisseurs of life, and in between each movie, we go out of our way to actually observe life and interact with real people, and we don't live in the buffer zone of valet cars and lunches in Hollywood, this, that, and the other. So I think the movies will get better over time. They won't get worse.
Well, we're all going to be looking forward to the next one. Albert Hughes, Alan Hughes, directors of the new film starring Denzel Washington, The Book of Eli. Thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank
Audie.
You. It was great.
Appreciate it.
How many of you absolutely dread parallel parking? A lot, I bet. Well, a British mathematician may have an answer. Geometry. Simon Blackburn, a professor at the University of London, says you can run a simple calculation, and voila, you're in. Here to discuss the theory is Keith Devlin, Weekend Edition's math guy. Welcome back, Keith.
Hi, Audie. Nice to be back again.
So what's the basic idea behind Professor Blackburn's research?
It's actually a very clever use of simple mathematics. In fact, the most complicated bit of mathematics it uses is our good old friend Pythagoras' theorem.
That's a squared plus b squared equals c squared, right?
Absolutely. And that's really all you need. You just need to use that in a clever way. You put in a few figures about the size of your vehicle and the space that you're trying to get into. And the formula tells you exactly how much extra space you need beyond the length of your vehicle in order to park it in a simple reverse in, straighten the wheels and switch the engine off move.
So give us a sense of how detailed the math is. What are the numbers you need to calculate using this system? And is it really practical?
Simon Blackburn's formula needs four pieces of information. First of all, you have to tell it the radius of your car's turning circle. That means if you give it a full lock to the left or right, it will turn in a circle. The radius of that thing is called the turning radius. It needs the wheelbase of your car, which is the distance between the centre of the front wheel and the rear wheel on either side. It needs the distance from your front wheel, from the centre of the front wheel, to the front bumper. And the one extra piece of information it needs, you know, you pull up next to a car, you need the width of that car.
Now, I went out and did my parking job, which does involve a certain kind of estimation, where I pull up to the first car, and as I'm reversing, I wait until the wheels sort of match up, then I jackknife into the space. And so I've got my own sort of estimation, and is a lot of this just based on your ability to do that kind of guesswork?
Yeah, and in fact, you know, there's lots of examples when people look at sort of baseball fielders and various athletes and people that put in wonderful shots on the basketball court. What's going on is that mathematics gives you a way of understanding in detail what people have learned to do simply by practice and expertise. In fact, when we practice something, be it on the athletic field or in an automobile, we are becoming very good mathematicians at doing a particular kind of operation, but usually we don't call it mathematics, and we certainly don't give people a pass on the math test because they can park their car.
Weekend Edition's math guy, Keith Devlin, also a professor at Stanford University. Keith, thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure, Audie.
As a native Bostonian, I consider myself a wicked good parka, so I decided to put my skills to the test right outside NPR headquarters. We pull up to the first car, length to length, nose to nose. You essentially want to measure, you're kind of like measuring the space by measuring this car in front of you. And the measure of a perfect parking job, according to this mathematician, is no back and forth. So that's what we're aiming for here. So now that my front wheel and their back wheel are lined up, I'm backing in. Release, release, release of the wheel. We're in the space. We're looking good. I'm stopping. How far are we from the curb? Okay. Oh, look at that. That's like 9 inches. That's genius. Beep, 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 yeah. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Most of us use search engines like Google, Bing, and Yahoo as our front door to the internet. We've grown accustomed to using keywords to search for everything from movie times to important issues dominating the news. But lately, researchers are paying more attention to the way children search for information online. Allison Druin is the director of the Human-Computer Interaction Lab at the University of Maryland. She joins us here in our Washington studios. Allison, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, your lab actually developed a study, which is sponsored by Google, we should say,
yes,
which focused on the ways children search for information online. So walk me through this. I'm 7 years old. I'm sitting down to the computer. I call up my favorite search engine because it's pretty or fun or cute looking, and I've got to look up some information on George Washington. What do I do that an adult wouldn't do?
Well, one of the things we asked, so could you find us some information on dolphins? Well, 7-year-old, quickly, boom, 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 boom. They found information on the Miami dolphins. And so they did not find out what dolphins eat. There were many children that just sat there and watched until they would find the information. As opposed to, hey, couldn't you do a keyword? No, this is what I do. I'll find it. Don't worry. We had one child swear he was going to find the vice president's birthday next year in the SpongeBob SquarePants website.
Somewhere.
Somewhere in
SpongeBob
there.
SpongeBob
had it, yeah.
What is it that parents can do right now to improve these skills?
Well, they can be mentors in the sense of trying to motivate a kid to go further and farther. Also, being able to let kids see how you search and what you do to refine a search. It's those multi-step questions that trip up most people. For example, we asked, what day next year will the vice president's birthday be on? Well, this was a very interesting question because it takes 3 different searches to actually find that question. Only about 0.5% of our kids could actually answer this question.
Can you describe to us what visual changes or aesthetic changes you could make that would improve the kids' chances of having successful searches?
If we change the result pages, most kids don't click past the first page. One of the things that we think that would be very valuable would be some sense of mentorship.
Mentorship from the computer.
Well, this is interesting. What we saw was there are many times where kids just sort of gave up, even though the information might have been there, or they didn't realize that they had just misspelled something, or kids say, oh, the information's not there, must not be important.
Would they do that? Would they essentially say, if the internet doesn't tell me so, it does not exist?
Yes. We saw this right off the bat from our early pilot studies. We found that boys stop faster than girls. And this is across all the age groups. Girls, they keep on trying, but they're less successful. And what's interesting is we found that there was less confidence in girls in terms of what they were doing. And so they'd say it was their problem, whereas the boys would try and problem solve further and they didn't see it as their problem.
Some things don't change.
Isn't it sad? it's so
like
sad.
I'm still learning. Allison Druin is the director of the Human-Computer Interaction Lab at the University of Maryland. She joined me here in the studio. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
A flock of whooping cranes flew to their winter homes in Florida this week, guided by ultralight aircraft. Experts say there are only 350 of these rare birds left in the world. Their arrival is becoming an annual spectacle that draws thousands of bird lovers. Vic Michelucci joined the waiting crowd near Tampa.
As the early morning fog cleared at the Dinellen Airport in Marion County, Florida, and the temperatures slowly rose, 8-year-old Eden Poucher waited with his family to see the whooping cranes for the very first time.
What's so cool about them?
That they can fly and they just follow the ultralight. It's really cool.
Is it going to be worth it to stand out here in the cold and get up early to come see them?
Yeah, a lot. Really worth it.
Coming to watch the cranes fly over has become a yearly routine for 82-year-old Florence Scarron.
I watch these whooping cranes from the time they are hatched and when they take off from Wisconsin till they come down here for the past 4 years. And also I watch them every day on the internet.
As the drone of an engine broke the morning silence, cameras clicked. 10 slender white birds with black wingtips passed overhead, trailing behind an ultralight aircraft. When fully grown, their wings will stretch to nearly 7 feet. It's part of Operation Migration, the mission, keep the endangered birds from extinction. Liz Condi has been with the group since it began in 2001.
there were zero in Eastern North America when we started migrating, that is, in, when we started this project. So over 100 is, we think, pretty good in 9 years.
Each year, Operation Migration pilots lead a new flock of young birds from Wisconsin to two Florida wildlife refuges, teaching them their winter migration.
There's nothing that can explain the feeling of accomplishment that you get when we finally release these birds here in Florida, knowing that we're adding to a population that 10 years ago didn't exist.
This is Richard Van Hoevelin leading the tent.
International Crane Foundation biologist Sarah Zamorski says the birds are starting on what should be a lifelong tradition.
They just have to be shown the way down south one time, whether it's with ultralights or with older birds, and then they know how to go back on their own in the spring, and so that's what they'll do. These birds that will spend the winter at the Chazawitska Release Pen, usually in late March, early April, they'll just decide one day it's the right day, and they'll get up and they'll go, and they'll head back north.
And as this year's trip wraps up, the Operation Migration crew looks at it as a success. All the young birds made it south safely, starting a new generation of a species still very much at risk. For NPR News, I'm Vic Micolucci.
This is NPR News.
To most of us, this sound is the sound of irrelevance. That's a VHS tape going into a VCR. But to Dimitri Samakis, it's the sound of angels dancing in heaven. Okay, maybe not angels, but it's a sound he's very familiar with. Every weekend or free afternoon he gets, Samakis and his buddies troll through bargain bins at charity shops and hang out at yard sales looking for old VHS tapes. But more specifically, they're looking for video gold, moments recorded on VHS, maybe a local newscast or a high school play or a commercial, clips that they then snip together and post online. They call their project Everything is Terrible, and Dimitri Samakis joins me from our studios at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
With some of these videos that you posted onto your website, you've sort of turned some of these people into celebrities. I'm thinking particularly of this woman in a video called So Your Cat Wants a Massage.
Yes.
And this
yes.
is literally a 3-minute video of a woman explaining how you can give your cat a massage.
If we understood fluent meow, our cats would tell us that petting is passé because your cat wants a massage. No oils or lotions are needed.
This had 750,000 hits. The woman has gone on to Letterman. How did you find this video?
This one was found in Chicago, Illinois, by actually our intern, Lur. And immediately when you watch it, of course, it's so wonderful.
I mean, he found it at like a thrift shop and he just popped it in the VHS?
I believe so, yeah. We've actually spoken to Mary Jean. She's a wonderful woman.
Oh, her name is Mary Jean?
Yeah, Mary Jean Ballner, I believe. And just her seeing it and getting it, what we were doing, was wonderful. You know, some people, I think, take it the wrong way, especially, you know, YouTube can be a very negative place. But she really understood, no, this is funny. I haven't seen this in probably 15 years. Thank you for bringing this back.
Okay, so how did this whole project, Everything is Terrible, how did it get started?
Everyone in the group, actually, is from Ohio. And over the years, we sort of just, you know, as video stores would be closing and as, you know, it got very cold in Athens, Ohio, the winters were not kind to us. And so we'd spend a lot of time just indoors, sitting around, trying to kind of outdo each other with the worst VHS tape or the most ridiculous movie or whatever. And just finding the most inspiring VHS tapes we can find.
Inspiring tapes that what, sort of tell us about who we are, who we were, you know, at a certain sort of this certain period in our history?
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's the excess that we had. It's the innocence that we had at that time. But really, you just have this amazing little time capsule where it's like, this happened and no one's ever going to see it again. We have to bring it back. It's this obsession with us at this point. It's an addiction, really.
There's another clip that we're going to play. It's got to be in the early or mid-90s. It's like three women meeting for lunch and they're talking about this new crazy thing.
Are you on the internet? Isn't that for techno geeks with spreadsheets?
Oh, Mel, you need the power.
We're Moms on the Net. We became Moms on the Net because there are so many resources available on the internet for moms and their families.
This was a tape called What the Heck's the Net? And how did they do it? What was the point? Who bought it? Who sold it? It's just such a mystery, and we love that tape. I mean, that tape is just a gold mine. Of just a lost era, you know. I mean, the tape is also only a little over 10 years old. I believe it's from like 1996, maybe. It's not that long ago, And it shows, like, how fast things have progressed. They're talking about www.this and www.that, and it's just so hilarious looking back on it, and it's not even that old.
Dimitri Simakis, recently you asked people who follow your website to send in their copies of the film Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
And I guess you've already received hundreds of them. Why do you want copies, VHS copies of Jerry Maguire?
We always have noticed since the beginning that there seems to be nothing but just Jerry Maguire tapes filling our nation's thrift stores and CD stores.
Jerry Maguire tapes all over the place.
It is insane. And it's a big, bright red VHS tape. So you look at it right from the side, your eyes immediately focus on it. And I'm telling you, we could go to a thrift store in D.C., one out here in Los Angeles, one in Jacksonville, Florida. I guarantee you they will be more Jerry Maguire's than anything else. I have no idea why. It was a very popular movie. I understand that. But so was, you don't see Titanic. You don't see, you know, Lawrence of Arabia. You just see Jerry Maguire
on VHS tape.
All the time. All the time. And so our goal is to have the world's largest collection since their departure at the factory.
You know, some people want to, cure diseases, and others want to collect all the Jerry Maguires.
Exactly.
That's Dimitri Simakis. He's with the group Everything is Terrible, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West in California. Dimitri Simakis, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And the Everything is Terrible folks also do live shows of their favorite clips. The next one is February 1st in Chicago. And for any of you who want to brush up on your cat massage techniques, you can find a link to that video at our website, npr.org.